Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and this is the Astrology Podcast. Today is, It's Friday, November 20th, 2015, at approximately 3 o'clock p.m., and this is actually going to be the 52nd or 53rd episode of the show. I'm not sure yet, because I'm supposed to release another one today. So in this episode, I'm going to be talking with Kelly Surtees and Austin Coppock about the astrological forecast for December of 2015, along with some auspicious dates that month for beginning different types of ventures and undertakings, using the principles of electional astrology. For more information about subscribing to the podcast, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. The podcast is made possible by listeners of the show who pledge their support through Patreon. We're doing the show in front of a live audience today of some of our top supporters who support the show at the $5 and $10 tiers, and so they'll be participating and doing a live Q&A and just asking questions and making comments during the course of the show. So I think that's it for introductions. So first I should welcome my two co-hosts, Austin Coppock and Kelly Surtees. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hey.
All right. So before we get started with the forecast and the astrological alignments for the month, why don't we see if there's any announcements to make? So I know that I've got a couple announcements. Why don't you go first, Kelly? What are you working on at the moment?
Oh, okay, cool. I am getting ready for my trip down under. I'm heading down to Australia for the holidays, Christmas, New Year's. But it also means I'll be doing some teaching in Sydney in January. And I've got a 2-day movement in the chart intensive that I'm teaching in Sydney, January 15 and 16, 2016. And there is an early bird rate for people who are interested. So for our listeners that are in Sydney or can get to Sydney, there's an early bird rate of just $195 that's available if you sign up before the end of November. So that's going to be a fun day. We're going to kind of bring in a bunch of interesting things to do with how to use movement in the chart, both in the natal chart and predictively.
Excellent. So people can find out more about that at your website, which is kellysastrology.com.
Exactly. Yes. Come on over or shoot me an email or grab me on Facebook, wherever's easy for people.
Great. All right. And Austin, what do you have going on?
Well, I've got a couple of things coming up. The one that is arriving soonest is that I'm actually going to be releasing some recordings of the classes I've been teaching all of this year for sale outside of a structured format. And those are all being edited frantically right now. And they should all be online and available for purchase by Thanksgiving weekend.
Excellent. So just like a week from now or a few days from now?
Yeah, like a week.
Great. All right. Well, people can check out your website for more about that, which is austincoppock.com.
That's right.
All right. And as for myself, I actually have to apologize because it's funny. This is actually the next episode after currently our previous episode, which was the forecast for November. So I'm running terribly behind with releasing podcast episodes this month. Although part of the reason for that is I was doing a ton of lecturing this month. And in order to balance out the episodes for this month, I'm actually going to release some of the other so the lectures that I've given this month as podcasts for free. One of them's on why whole sign houses is the best house system, which I actually might release before I release this episode, in which case this will be episode 53 and whole sign houses will be episode 52. I also just finished recording a series of new 9-hour lecture on ancient Hellenistic Time Lord techniques, specifically one on annual perfections. So I'm really excited about that. I've been working on it for a year, and you can find out more information about it at HellenisticAstrology.com. All right, so let's get into our topic for the month. So first, actually, instead of jumping right into the actual alignments for this month, I wanted to do a little bit of recap because there's actually been a lot of relevant astrology stories in the news lately. Especially, I've noticed a bunch of Saturn and Sagittarius type stuff, both in terms of mundane astrology, just in terms of the news, but also just in terms of, people with Saturn and Sagittarius are now full on hitting their Saturn returns. And especially some of the people that have Saturn early in that sign, it seems to be showing up very prominently very early on. So, you know, the first one and the biggest one, of course, that we've talked about as sort of a running theme for the past few months has been, you know, Saturn in Sagittarius and its relation to, you know, that which is foreign and its relation to some of the things that are going on in terms of some of the immigration that's taking place in Europe and sort of around the world right now. And a lot of that seems like it's been coming to a head over the past few weeks, just in terms of the international sort of attention towards it. Does it feel like it's been that way to you guys, or is that just me?
No, I think that's a pretty inarguable statement. The recent events in Paris have brought attention to the immigration crisis, even here in the United States. You know, there was no national discourse, or there's very little national discourse about accepting Syrian refugees 3 weeks ago in the U.S. And now it's, you know, it's all over the Facebook and the internet. And it certainly brought it to a fevered pitch in Europe. And as you know, as I hope you guys remember, last month we talked about how the Saturn-Neptune square, with Saturn being laws and borders and Neptune being that which is amorphous and that which often requires compassion, did a really good job of symbolically outlining the refugee crisis. And we said that we thought that the exact squares, especially this one coming up, coming up here at the end of November, would be one of the peaks both a peak and a turning point as far as mapping the trajectory of that crisis and its resolution goes. And so here we are.
Yeah. And if you listen to the Saturn and Sagittarius episode, that is one of the specific topics that we talked about, especially towards the end of that episode, about Saturn and Sagittarius potentially coinciding with. And also, I think at one point even noting that some of the things that happened in the preview phase earlier this year with Saturn initially going into Sagittarius, like the Charlie Hebdo sort of attacks or crisis, as potentially being a, you know, indication of other themes that might come up, ended up being sort of prescient as well. What do you think, Kelly, or what's your observation been lately?
Yeah, the theme, I guess, that keeps coming up that is part of this is the idea of blurred boundaries or permeable borders, I guess, which is very much the Saturn in Sag kind of combination with Neptune in Pisces. And one topical thing coming out of Australia, there is definitely more happening or more discussion in the press and in the mainstream about refugees, even in Australia, certainly here in Canada. We've had a new government elected based on a promise of allowing something like 25,000 Syrian refugees into the country. But the idea of that blurred boundaries or permeable borders, one thing that's happening in the Commonwealth countries at the moment is there is a push to make it easier for Australians, Canadians and the British to move between the three countries without having to sort of formally apply for visas and things like that in advance. That Australia and New Zealand have this relationship where you can just travel freely. If you're an Australian citizen or a New Zealand citizen, you don't need any special paperwork to cross those borders. You can just show up with your New Zealand passport and they'll let you into Australia. So there's a discussion going on that's not so specific to refugees per se, but the idea of the permeable borders. But the refugees crisis is really bringing that to a larger, to the bigger picture, which is this idea of, you know, safety and security and freely allowing people that need access to that to come in. So it's definitely the Saturn Neptune really coming through, and we're not even at the exact hit of that first square yet. We've still got another week or 10 days, you know, at the date of our recording here to get into that.
Right. And I mean, one of the things that's really interesting now in the aftermath of the Paris attacks is one of the big themes I know that modern astrologers always talk about when it comes to Saturn is the idea of Saturn indicate something that you fear. And usually it's interesting because that's framed within the context of the natal chart and like natal placements of Saturn in the houses as being areas of like anxiety or fear in some sense. And I think it's interesting that now a lot of the discussion about, you know, not accepting refugees into like the US for some, for whatever reason, is based on like fears surrounding like national security or like terrorist attacks or what have you. So that, I guess Obama just like yesterday had to get together, like a conference call of like all of the governors in the United States for all 50 states and tell them that they couldn't, you know, override national laws regarding, you know, accepting immigrants into different parts of the country, but that that was set by the federal government rather than the sort of local governments, regardless of whatever concerns or sort of fears that people had regarding that. Anyway, so I just bring it up because I thought it was interesting that one of those simple keywords of Saturn is then being imported into the sort of domain of Sagittarius. Yeah. And so a lot of the discourse really is simply revolving around like fear and anxiety concerning like foreigners, essentially.
Fear of foreigners. That's really the theme that's coming out.
Another very basic Saturn and Sagittarius key concept is it's Saturn in the sign of Jupiter, and Jupiter is the traditional ruler of religious activity, especially activity by established religions.
Right.
We talk about Saturn and Sag and heightened criticism of religion, and it's not just foreigners, but it is specifically the most religious foreigners and foreigners of a particular religion that the fears are anchored to.
Right.
So it's sort of double Saturn and Sag.
Yeah.
And that's been an issue like in the US where there was like some news story about or there's been different news stories about different like Islamic centers getting vandalized or different mosques getting vandalized in the US over the past week or so. And then it was actually kind of funny, but a local metaphysical bookstore here in Denver is called Isis Books, and somebody vandalized the sign, I think, because they associated it with Isis, the, you know, whatever terrorist organization.
Work.
Yeah. So, yeah, that idea of like fear, but also like a sort of reactionary sort of movement towards that, that is sometimes very I don't want to say like violent isn't usually the term I would go for, but it's a very sort of reactionary, sudden sort of gut reaction to that that can be very stark sometimes and not necessarily very pretty.
Yeah. Just one quick note on that. So Saturn here is, we're seeing Saturn in the first decan of Sagittarius, and the vast majority of the images which are used to describe the first decan of Sagittarius show figures that are swift and armed.
Mm.
And so even more so than the other decans of Sagittarius, where we're, you know, we're dealing with something that's really quick. And then, you know, symbolically, when a sign or, you know, a decan or something else is armed, it means that it's aggressive in its response to things. We've certainly seen swift armed responses.
Mm. Well, yeah, even the way that Paris and the French sort of police have swiftly moved to respond or to retaliate, and there was certainly no pause there. They responded very quickly. Even here in Canada, very locally to where we live, there has been a mosque attacked as well. So it's that, I guess, reactionary component does seem to be alive and well.
Sure. And, I mean, it's really... It's fascinating just because we did that whole Saturn and Sagittarius episode. It's the longest one I've ever recorded, but this, you know, it's interesting seeing some of those themes just play out so literally only just a couple of months later, in terms of what we were anticipating some of the main themes would be, just understanding the basic symbolism. And speaking of like religious stuff, I also picked up on another news story within the past week where, the title of the news story that was going around was thousands of Mormons are leaving the church over a new gay apostate policy where the Mormon church, I guess, officially changed their stance or codified what their actual stance has always been in very stark terms about towards sort of same-sex couples. And this has led some large groups of Mormons to like publicly resign from the church, which I thought was interesting as well in terms of some additional sort of Saturn and Sagittarius themes surrounding religions and sort of issues surrounding that.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. And one other side topic that's connected with this, I don't know if you want to get into it, but it's actually a worthwhile topic, maybe more broadly speaking, just about the practice of astrology and the process of astrology. But one of the observations that you made, Austin, last week was that you had some reticence or some reservations about some of the commentary on the Paris attacks that was happening like immediately after it happened, and this sort of broader issue about how astrologers sort of process events and how they observe the world, but also how they talk about them publicly. Do you feel like that's something you want to talk about or reflect on here since we're talking about those attacks now?
Sure. I mean, I already put something out on Facebook and it spawned like 300 likes and 70 comments. So the cat is out of the bag.
Sure.
So I believe it was last Saturday night, which is like the day after. And on my feed, there were just, you know, it felt like there were hundreds of astrologers going off on the Paris attacks. And my thought was, you know what? I know some people who live in Paris, right? And I know people who have friends in Paris. And if I were them and I saw that, that would not be helping, right? And so I really just had the term, I believe, was I was uncomfortable with it. I had a discomfort with it. I tried to frame my comments in personal and subjective language because that's where it's coming from, right? Mm-hmm. And I said that I'm uncomfortable with, you know, with people, with astrologers just racing, you know, within hours of a tragedy. And it's not just about, you know, it's not just about Paris. You know, this is something that comes up every time there's a school shooting, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
I instantly start thinking about planetary factors and talking about this with, you know, with astro, you know, with my astro homies. But I don't know. I guess I was uncomfortable and still am about the way that people speak about things when they're really fresh in a totally public way. And what I said is just that I think you can do that with the tact and compassion that that requires. But I don't see nearly enough astrologers taking the time to do that. And, you know, it really got me thinking about how we've never, you know, this is sort of a isn't the internet crazy moment where we've never, you know, none of us are used to living in a world where we can basically hear each other's thoughts in public 24/7.
Sure.
Right. And there's no, you know, I don't think there's any moral problem with you and I talking about it, or you and I, Kelly,
yeah.
You know, 1 minute after it happens. But when you do things publicly, you know, you're speaking to people who are affected by it at the same time. And then there's just a general kind of ethical guideline for me. Right. And again, I'm not trying to impose this is my thinking on it and how I try to comport myself is I feel like we should always be a little thoughtful when we sit down and try to tell somebody else's story, especially if that story is raw and painful. I feel like that goes for race, class, gender, sexual orientation, and everything else in between. And if we can just be a little thoughtful about how we tell somebody else's story, that might be better for everybody.
Yeah, I agree, Austin. I didn't comment on Facebook, mostly because I had the feeling it was a bit of a minefield. And sometimes I just think I'd rather talk about that in person with people. But I do think, and this is the sort of, it's personal, you know, my response, just like you said yours, it's the term that comes to mind, and I think this one of you guys might have noted this down earlier, but the idea of ambulance chasing, I feel like it's a little bit in bad taste to jump on to something like this. I think some people are very genuine in terms of wanting to perhaps shed light on what's going on and using the astrological symbolism to do so. Mm-hmm. And I think that some people are a little bit more targeted around, you know, things like, maybe this is just me being paranoid or suspicious, but that idea of, you know, search engine, this is a buzz topic, it's trending, let's get something out there with my name on it that's associated with this.
Right.
And on the one hand, I can't fault the business sort of side of that, but when it is a still unfolding tragedy, I do think that a little bit of perhaps caution or reflection, particularly as you're saying, Austin, in the public sphere, I think perhaps those conversations, you might want to flesh them out a little bit with people behind closed doors that maybe you trust or that, you know, is in that inner circle. I find it a little bit off-putting, and it sort of turns me off social media when we are in some of those difficult scenarios, because I don't know that it's helpful. I don't know that it's helpful to hear that kind of stuff in the thick of it.
Right. So that reminds me, I just want to jump in with two things. So one was, you know, bad taste is really exactly how I was feeling. And some people felt like I was laying down a moral blanket statement and dictating the law to them, which is absolutely not where I'm at. It's just like, it makes me uncomfortable. It leaves a bad taste in my mouth, you know? And let's leave it at that. You know, you're not going to, people certainly shouldn't be worried about pleasing me. Or
no.
Leaving, you know? Yeah. But another part of that, that I kind of unpacked through the discussion for myself was that there's also this sort of, oh, I predicted that.
Oh,
that right. People, and it's like, you know, I've written an almanac for years, and sometimes what I say is creepily close to what happens, but it's not a prediction.
Mm.
Right? Like, you know, there's a lot of like, well, I said today would be terrible and look, it was terrible. It's like that's not a prediction. And it is also, I think, a disservice to astrology when astrologers claim to have predicted things that they only loosely rhymed with.
Yeah.
So that is also bound up in it.
Yeah. And I think that's that idea of the disservice, that's probably what I have a response to, which is the idea that I'm not sure that this is serving people, and I'm not sure that this is serving astrology to have, you know, because I think there are certainly, and you guys know, there are amazing techniques that are fairly involved and complex that allow people to predict with a high level of accuracy, you know, times of turmoil and trials and tribulation for countries as much as for people. And I think to sort of throw things together in the heat of the moment does a bit of a disservice to the work that there are some specialized sort of mundane astrologers out there that are doing that is very thoughtful and very considered. That comes out in the wash, you know, weeks and months later. It's like, yeah, that's right. This was, you know, where it's more than just a rhyme with it, where somebody was more targeted and picked a location and a time frame. And I think, yeah, it's that idea of disservice that probably grates on me a little bit too.
Yeah.
I mean, some of that is like with, you know, the news networks, it's often commented on that the 24-hour news cycle and the sort of commercialization, maybe commercialization isn't the right word, but sort of the new news networks becoming 24-hour things, they're constantly having to pump out news, has led to this sort of like cheapening and to more of like an entertainment sort of treatment of the news. And in the same way with astrology, like I think part of what's going on here is that, because I have some experience with this, when you're writing an astrology blog, oftentimes one of the things that you're writing about is current events. And so there's lots of different current events, you know, like somebody got elected president or prime minister, or, you know, some major event happened, some movie star, you know, got into a new movie, or some movie became really popular or bombed or something like that. And astrologers are constantly writing about those events on a daily basis in these blogs. And then sometimes something really big happens and there is this question about how soon to cover it and whether you should cover it and what you should say. And that's sort of where the gray area is a little bit, because on the one hand, I definitely sympathize with what Austin's saying, because it does, there's something about it that sometimes feel like it's in poor taste when you definitely see people, because when you're writing an astrology blog, you're trying to write about current events, because if you write the article first before anyone else does, you'll draw in a ton of traffic of people that are searching for that keyword to see what the astrologers are saying about it. And so astrologers get in the habit of doing that. But then as a result of that, they also end up sort of chasing after more, you know, difficult or tragic stories as well. And there's something a little unsettling about that. But one of the things that makes this an interesting topic is just, where do you draw the line? Because it's such a gray area of, you know, at what point or how long should you wait? Or, you know, at what point does a story become too much of a tragedy versus more of a current event that it becomes distasteful, just as part of the discussion.
So I have maybe a rule of thumb that I'm going to be trying to use, because this has been really helpful. It's been really helpful for me to put some thoughts out there and to get so much feedback. And so one of the, I guess there's a rule of thumb, like, just write as if the people it's happening to can hear you.
Right. Mm.
Because they can, or because they might, because it's public. And that doesn't mean be silent, but it means, you know, just be respectful.
Sure.
And I don't feel like being respectful is too much to ask of astrologers. Astrology itself is ridiculously hard. It's much harder than just being respectful. So I think we could probably, if there's a rule of thumb, that one's not too draconian.
No.
Sure. Yeah, be respectful. And yeah, I mean, that's tough, because certainly we understand the impetus or the desire to want to like talk about those things publicly, since certainly everybody as astrologers, once you get into this mindset and that becomes part of your worldview, you'll immediately look through some event like that through the lens of astrology. And sometimes that can lead to like wanting to discuss it with other people. But I guess, yeah, it becomes a gray area of like, when are you discussing ideas versus where are you almost like exploiting something for traffic or for views or something like that, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's a great summary, essentially.
All right. Well, maybe we'll return back to that later. I mean, I'm sure, unfortunately, because this is becoming more and more of a topic. Like, I remember thinking this, you know, like a few tragedies ago, that it was kind of weird that all the astrologers were jumping on top of this. So I'm sure that this will be a topic that we'll return to at some point in the future for maybe more of a careful, considered discussion of both sides. All right. So, oh, yeah. So the other thing I wanted to mention before we finish our Saturn return in Sag, our Saturn in Sagittarius sort of recap, is I noticed two really prominent Saturn returns happening over the course of the past month. The first one was that Shia LaBeouf actually did this really funny and really weird thing where he, earlier this month, for a specific like 3-day time period, he decided to rent out a theater and watch all of his movies in reverse chronological order, from the most recent one he did all the way till one he did when he was like 12. And in the process, ended up basically reviewing his entire life. But he set up a webcam and broadcasted it on this website, so you could kind of like watch his reaction as he was watching through his entire life chronology for basically the second half of his life, essentially. And what I found fascinating about that is, for whatever reason, it exactly coincided with his exact Saturn return at 5 degrees and 22 minutes of Sagittarius. And you'll remember that a few episodes ago in the Saturn in Sag one, he was actually one of the people where I was really curious how his Saturn return was going to turn out, because it's such a prominent planet in his chart, ruling the ascendant and being in the 11th whole sign house, but I think conjunct the midheaven, or within the vicinity of the midheaven. So I don't know if this was deliberate. I mean, it's almost too coincidental. And because he was doing it with two other artists who have done other kind of like art projects before, you kind of wonder if somebody didn't tell him that it was his Saturn return and that's why he centered it on that. He certainly didn't say that publicly, but it's kind of suggestive that perhaps he knew and planned it that way. But on the other hand, it also, we can't take that for granted, and it certainly could have just been a natural expression of like what he was feeling or what a person would be feeling as they're going in through their Saturn return, and that element of wanting to review and sort of reflect on one's life up to that point. Did you guys notice that when he was doing it? It was kind of like in the news, and I thought it was pretty funny.
Yeah, it was really cool. One thing I often think about a Saturn return, the experience of it, is it's like you're giving yourself a report card on how well you've done in life so far.
Right.
And I think you've mentioned this on Facebook or what have you. And I thought, oh, that's fascinating, because what a way to give yourself a report card to see your progress. I mean, phenomenal. If we all had these little vignette experiences where, you know, if we all had made movies or written books or even published articles, perhaps, and you go back and you look at them in reverse order, I mean, right. Phenomenal.
Yeah. It's like really getting a chance to see yourself at different stages in your like evolution as a human being and eventually as an adult.
Yeah. Like watching yourself grow up.
Right. And I mean, part of that, for I'm sure for most people, but also for him, is there's going to be parts where you look back on really fondly, and that seemed to be the case for him, especially in one of his older movies, one of his first movies, when he was like 13 or 14 or 12 or something like that, he seemed to really get a kick out of. But then at other times, you think of like going back and looking at yourself in the past and how much you might sort of like cringe or, you know.
That's what I could never do it, because I'd be cringing the whole time, I think. Like, oh.
Right. So just imagine watching like three-day sort of review of that, yeah. Of like seeing yourself grow up. It's like the perfect sort of Saturn return experience. And I really appreciated it for that reason, because he's sometimes like a controversial figure or somebody that people don't like very much or criticize for different reasons. But it's like, regardless of how you feel about him, it was interesting seeing that as sort of a live, exact televised Saturn return. But also it really did seem to build a lot of like sympathy and sort of community around him, which I thought was really interesting, both in terms of that Saturn placement itself as the ruler of his ascendant, contrary to the sect, but also the fact that it was in the 11th house. And I saw some post report with him, some recap where he almost seemed to say something very 11th housey about feeling like he had friends or feeling like he had a community as a result of it, that there were people behind him. Yeah, it was a really good, like Joe's saying, it was a really good, perfect sort of 11th house Saturn return moment.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So did you see that, Austin? Or do you think that was the first televised Saturn return? I mean...
I'm sure many have been televised unofficially.
Sure, like accidentally.
Yeah, you know, I actually missed that. I've had a very busy last couple of weeks. Right.
Had a few other things going on, Austin.
Right. You know, I got married and was exhausted and stuff. but yeah, no, I missed that. I did see one of our other news items that we wanted to discuss. That's Saturn and Sagi. And so I'd really like to talk about that. But whenever you're ready, Shia LaBeouf, great.
Do it. Is this the MMA fighting business?
Yeah, we were going to talk about Ronda Rousey. If you guys are you guys done with Shia LaBeouf?
Yeah, I think I kind of
Shia LaBeouf. So,
oh, you're not a fan?
No.
Okay. Yeah, and well, that's what's so funny to me about it is like he's one of those people that has Saturn as the malefic that's contrary to the sect ruling the ascendant, and so it's like there is this like sense that a lot of people have where for, you know, various reasons they like don't like him or there's something about him that they don't like, even though you don't know him personally. It's just whatever his persona is. And I think that's such a fascinating manifestation of that and seeing that happened. But one of the things that was weird about the exact Saturn return is you almost had a weird inversion of that at the return. And I'm actually not fully sure why that was, because he actually got really good press and coverage from this and seemed to have a lot of positive feelings around it. It was not like a negative Saturn return experience necessarily, I don't think, from what I can tell. Yeah, so he's still got a couple of years to go. I mean, he's got to get through the rest of Sagittarius. This was just sort of a high point or one of the most pivotal moments, but we'll see what's happened. So let's go on to your more favorable Saturn return story, which is Ronda Rousey.
I don't know if this is favorable.
Well, yeah. One of your more favorite celebrities. So in a surprise upset, Ronda Rousey, who was like the top champion female MMA fighter and who's become just like this, not just celebrity, but like somebody who was very prominent and very well thought of over the past year. Like it's been interesting.
So really, she blew up during Venus's retrograde through Leo.
Right,
she was like she was like the poster girl for Venus retrograde or for the Venus cycle in Leo, which is interesting because she's actually a Sun in Aquarius. So this was all opposite her Sun, which is kind of interesting. Anyway, she got a ton of press. She was up until last Saturday night undefeated in her professional MMA. career. And, you know, I personally feel like the reason that, you know, she got all of the ESPN cover and this cover, I feel like she's the person that made, you know, half of America realize that women can be badass too. That like, that's what happens when you train for 8 hours a day for 15 years.
Sure.
It doesn't matter what your genitals are. Like you become a monster. But anyway, yeah, so Ronda Rana had just been crushing everyone, like literally beating most of her opponents in like 30 seconds or a minute. Like not even, they weren't contests. The vast majority of her wins are just, she runs in there, beats them, and it's over. And we don't have a birth time for her, but we do have
No, we actually do. We have a birth time for her. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, so, okay. Awesome. What's her rising?
You're going to love this. She actually has Gemini rising.
Okay.
So that Saturn's angular, but it's also in a day chart.
And so I love this. Hold on. So that means she has Mars in Aries conjunct the North Node in the 11th.
And
we want
to
talk about out of sect malefics in the 11th. So 11th is your audience. 11th is where everybody can see you, and everybody sees her just steamrolling people, right?
Right.
So what was interesting, and so the reason that she's on topic with Shia LaBeouf is she's also a Saturn in Sag. And so this was her first fight since Saturn moved back into Sag in September. She did have a fight in end of February when Saturn was doing his little toe dangling into the pool of Sagittarius. But this is and she won that one handily, but this is the first one since Saturn's moved back into Sag for keeps, right? You know, there's this sense of whenever a planet moves into a new sign, but it's actually just going to move back, that the significations are a little different. But, you know, Saturn moved into Sag for keepsies in September. And so this is her first fight since then, since she'd been so pumped up. And she just got hammered. She just got destroyed. You know, people, she basically, I would say she got taken apart. And what's really interesting for me as someone who's done lots and lots of martial arts, been my only like sport and physical activity since I was like 12, is watching the Mars. So her fight happened one day into Mars's return into Libra, which is something that features very heavily in the coming month, and is certainly an important part of recent events. And so it's interesting. So last year she had Mars retrograde in Libra opposite her Mars. And this on her first fight, when Mars has just come back to that territory, which was so loaded up by last year's retrograde, she's dismantled. And the precise manner in which she just dismantled illustrated to me the Libra and Aries symbolism so well. So basically she's a Mars North Node in Aries. So this is going to be shocking, but she goes right up. She goes right for people and punches them, takes them down, and then breaks their arm. And that's all there is. She just runs up, smash, right? And then it's really quick. And so her opponent, Holly Holm, I haven't seen her chart, but she certainly embodied the Mars in Libra. And so if we're talking about a Libran strategy, so what does the Libra do when somebody comes in and is very rude and tries to break their arm? They politely sidestep and then maybe offer a riposte of some sort. And Holly Holm just politely sidestepped Ronda Rousey and then maybe gave her a punch in the face like 20 times. And Rhonda gets increasingly frustrated and sloppy and just keeps trying to get in there and win real quick. And it just doesn't work because Holly just sidesteps and is like, actually punch you in the face. And then that basically leads to the point where Rhonda gets like, you know, like I think the eighth, like in like 7 minutes, like the eighth, like solid backhand cross to the face. And then she goes down for a little bit. And then when she, you know, attempts to stand up, Holly kicks her in the face, and it's done. And so just seeing the Libra-Aries thing, it was like, you know, the direct versus the polite manner of dealing with conflict.
Wow.
Definitely. And there was also this element, I mean, the set of return element for me is that there was this sort of being taken down a notch and this sort of like fall from grace element, because she was being heralded. She was really being like exalted. And now a lot of people, it's like as soon as she was defeated, suddenly people are coming out of the woodworks and saying, oh, she wasn't that great anyways. Or, you know, I'm glad now everybody sees that she's not as good as everybody was saying that she was the best fighter in 100 years, or that she could beat the top male, like what is his name, Floyd Mayweather. People were saying that they could go into a match together and that she could easily beat like the top male MMA fighter. And So there may have been this issue of her in this like meteoric rise over the past year or so, sort of becoming too big in like the public's eye compared to like what she was actually capable of, or maybe just there was an over idealization, let's say, not to like diminish from like what her actual accomplishments are or skills are, but that there may have been like an over idealization, and then she really got brought down low with this defeat, because then everybody, suddenly a lot of people turned on her, and she's getting the opposite end of the spectrum of of what some of her opponents had gotten previously, I guess.
I think it's really fair to say that she was idealized. As I said earlier, I think that she was one of the reasons why she was everywhere is she was the first person who convinced, who for a lot of people who realized that, oh, like, you know, women really can be totally badass, right? And so, you know, I think people projected a lot of things onto her. And when you get a ton of stuff projected onto you, then it's, you know, it's only partially about you, and it's not right up to you when that bubble pops. But she's, you know, she's an Olympic, she's literally an Olympic world-class athlete, and she'll be fine.
Well, what's next is talking about the rematch, and that's actually really interesting when the actual, you know, this is supposed to be a double A time or an A time on Astro Data Bank. So if this chart is true, then she actually has a day chart and she hasn't hit the exact Saturn return yet. But, you know, if she had a night chart, I would think maybe she's going to have more problems here in the future. But since this is a day chart, like oftentimes day chart people will have the you know, thing that comes in that knocks them down a peg, but then they have to then exert a bunch of effort to like overcome it, and eventually they're able to and they're successful. So I really wouldn't be surprised to see her make like a major comeback at some point, and they're already talking about doing a rematch as soon as possible. So I'm wondering if that's not, you know, the route through which she sort of redeems herself during the later part of her Saturn return. But at least during this initial part, it seems like the theme is, you know, getting really high, but then having a fall, and now where she goes from there.
Right. Well, and Saturn rules her sun in Midheaven and Mercury. So it would make sense that Saturn's movements would be collected or connected to very public events in her life.
Right. Definitely.
Well, and her exact Saturn return by degree is not actually until December 2016.
So a year from now?
Yeah, so there's still a fair bit of time for that to develop, I guess.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, it's just like, imagine what she's like going through right now. Because she was like at the top of the world, and like everybody thought she was like the greatest thing ever. And then she got defeated in this surprise upset. And just imagine, it's like you're having a really heavy Saturn transit, and then like suddenly everyone in the world watches you literally like get knocked out or get punched in the face.
Knocked out. Yeah.
Yeah. It was very dramatic and very notable as sort of like an example of a Saturn return, and what the sort of challenging end of the Saturn return in a very literal sense can sometimes be how it can be experienced. All right. Well, we've talked for about 40 minutes about like our review phase, so maybe we should move on to the actual forecast.
Talk about December.
Yeah. All right. So let's take a look at what are some of the major themes coming up. Like, maybe we'll focus on the broader rather than the shorter term stuff. But what are some of the broader themes and aspects that we can sort of anticipate coming up here in the next few weeks in December of 2015?
Well, go ahead, Kelly.
I was just going to say the word that came to mind when I was reading over all of our prep notes was like a flashback month in one way, which is the Uranus-Pluto kind of just coming back a little bit and being triggered by Mars and Mercury. But then I think this might have been your point, Austin, or maybe it was Chris, but the real mutable focus now that we've got the sun coming back into Sag, and then Jupiter in Virgo, Saturn in Sag, Neptune in Pisces, we're starting to really see some of those new aspects, like Saturn square Jupiter is going to happen around mid-month. So it's a flashback on the one hand with the – sorry, did I say Saturn square Jupiter? I meant to say sun square Jupiter. I was watching your face, Austin, and I'm like, clearly I've used the wrong word, the S words. Sun square Jupiter. Yeah, so that a little bit of Uranus Pluto kind of coming back, and I think one of the big themes for December, of course, is Mars in Libra, which will be interesting.
Yeah, so that's the entire month is basically Mars going through Libra.
Yes.
Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, this is Mars's first time back in Libra after a very dramatic and in many ways disastrous retrograde through the sign during the late winter and spring of 2014. Just for a point of reference, as to the nature of the events that happened last time we had this big Mars in Libra with the retrograde, the day of the retrograde station was when Russia annexed the Crimea, which led to all sorts of not very awesome things happening for lots of people. And so now, and with Mars's return to Libra, Mars returned to Libra basically last Friday and sort of traded places with the North Node regressing back into Virgo while Mars progressed into Libra. And that is one of the things that was happening astrologically when the Paris attacks occurred. And I also personally, I saw just watching people as I do and watching charts, I saw a lot of little scuffles break out on a personal level between people during that first 4 or 5 days of Mars in Libra. There's this idea from Hellenistic astrology that a planet shows its significations more dramatically when it enters a sign. And so I saw that. And so it's very interesting to know that Mars, as it continues through Libra, will re-enter the exact degrees of its retrograde from 2014. And as it does so, it will find itself in a T-square with Uranus and Pluto. And Uranus and Pluto, although they will not be perfectly squaring again, to the minute for well over 100 years. They won't be. It's not 100 years. They won't
not
be
this month.
They won't be the waxing square like this for over 100 years. But anyway, they're not going to be perfectly square again. But this December is about as close as they're ever going to get. It's going to be like two and a half degrees. And you'll have Mars opposing Uranus and squaring Pluto, which should be challenging.
Let me give the dates so our listeners have them, Austin. We've got December 6th and 7th, so Sunday, Monday, Mars square Pluto, and then Mars opposite Uranus, December 10 and 11. So 10th if you're in Canada and the US, be the 11th if you're down in Australia or in the Southern Hemisphere. So interesting is your word for that, Austin.
It's worth paying attention to. The thing about, let's see how to, I don't know if I want to delineate this.
It's just a bit unpredictable, a bit of a roller coaster.
Yeah. The thing is, if there's an instability, if there's a deep instability in some relationship or area of life, there's a high chance of things blowing up around that time. Mars Uranus aspects, especially hard aspects, are very volatile in and of themselves. Mm. And when you have Pluto putting pressure on these things, one, you get these sort of explosions coming from a hidden place, right? Pluto does that. Pluto likes to push things down so that they pop up twice as much. And so it sort of pressurizes and brings this sort of volcanic symbolism into play. And so it doesn't mean everything's going to explode all at once. It will most likely be another one of many important moments in this sort of very long unfolding Uranus Pluto story, which has been going on since 2011, 2012, depending on when where you set that date. And then on a personal level, like if you have planets that are in the middle of cardinal signs, you know, you might need to keep your cool. It's certainly not a calming configuration. It doesn't last that long, but it's, you know, it can make for, you know, it can shorten fuses considerably. And on a personal level, when we have things like this, sometimes it's just people maybe talking about things that need to get talked about, but in a way that is not, you know, in a way that is much more destructive than it needs to be. Sometimes you have the fight that you need to have, but you did it in a way that you really wish you could have talked about it any other way. And yeah. So it's that kind of thing for a lot of folks on a personal level, as far as like a weather go, you know, the kind of weather report goes.
The astro weather. Yeah, it's hitting 14 and 16 degrees of the cardinal signs. And it does have that. I mean, I always think when Mars comes into a bigger configuration like that, we get that sense of things being ignited or, you know, and sometimes they need to be come out and burn through. I think the one thing, and you know me, I'm like, what's good about this? The one thing that's good about this is it's not happening later in the month over the Christmas holiday New Year period.
Oh yeah, that is good.
So I can't make the energy seem any better because of course it is Mars, Uranus, Pluto. It's volatile by its nature, combustible, but it's happening, you know, and it's basically the second week of December. We start on the Sunday and we have it coming up at the end of that week. It's right before the new moon in Sagittarius. So there's a dark moon, kind of a waning moon overlooking that. In that period too, the sun's going to trine Uranus. So it's that second week of December looks a little bit choppy and changey. And you may want to keep your cool or just be a little bit flexible. Don't be too rigid about things. And that's probably the most dramatic thing this month, I think, for December. Mm-hmm. Did you guys spot anything else of any kind of greater calamity?
No, I mean, like Mercury hits its shadow towards the end of the month or in the second half of the month. That's not any huge calamity, I don't think, but.
Well, so one thing that we should mention regarding Mercury is that because Mercury is going to be getting ready for an early January retrograde.
Yeah.
It means that he is just flying through signs during December, right? He he makes it basically through the second half of Sag and then almost all of Capricorn. So he does, what does he do? He does something like 45 degrees of movement or something in December. It's
like a day.
No, 40, like...
Pardon, 45 degrees through the zodiac. You're right. December 1st, Mercury is at 15 Sag, and December 31st, we're at 28 Cap. So absolutely, we're covering a sign and a half.
Right. And so, you know, with that, when a planet is moving very fast, that means that affairs which are connected to that planet move very fast, right? So it's, you know, just, you know, like conversations and ideas, like the mind speeds way ahead. And some of those things will need to be returned to, and some of it, especially for the first part,
almost. Yeah.
Yeah,
it hits the shadow like, around the solstice.
It's just stuff that it's just things that need to be done and then you move on. You're not coming back to them, but there's a rapidity of pace, when a planet is moving that quickly, and because Mercury has a faster fast and a slower slow than a lot of the planets, you see that really pronounced.
One of the things I noticed, and that's why I actually mentioned that, is the thing after the Mars, Uranus, Pluto T-square, is that Mercury, when it retrogrades, it'll station retrograde in early January at zero Aquarius, then it'll retrograde back, and it stations direct at 14 Capricorn. Mm-hmm. So that's actually right around all those critical degrees with the cardinal signs.
Oh yeah, good point.
So that means that Mercury's shadow actually begins in like mid-December once it hits about 14 degrees of Capricorn.
Yeah, it stations direct on Pluto.
Yeah. So which means
December 19.
And it stations retrograde square Mars and Scorpio. But that's January.
Yeah.
We can ignore that.
For next month.
Right. Nice.
Yeah, so it is hitting off that T-square a little bit.
All right. Well, that's fun.
Yeah, so that's Mercury.
So people that have Mercury activated this year, or people who that's hitting a prominent part of their chart might be especially sort of sensitive to that retrograde and that shadow that's coming up.
Yeah.
And one more thing to note about Mercury, because, you know, again, that last third of the month will be Mercury preparing for his retrograde. Mm-hmm. And so that retrograde, which we'll be preparing for at the end of this year, is going to be is announcing a new set of Mercury retrogrades, which are going to take place primarily in Earth signs. They've been in air signs all this year. And while this next one is going to station retrograde in an air sign, Aquarius, it's only going to do that in, like, you know, the first degree. Almost the entire thing is going to be in Capricorn. And, you know, our next year is going to be all Mercury retrograde in Earth signs. So that's a triplicity shift that's worth noting.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating when you look at the annual shifts that we do typically see Mercury retrograde. A couple of years ago, it was Mercury retrograde through the water signs. And so each water sign, one of the things that's interesting around that is that Mercury spends so much time in a sign when it's retrograde. You know, starting, for example, around December 10th, Mercury goes into Capricorn, and other than just a couple of days when it dips into Aquarius early in January, Mercury is in Capricorn until the middle of February. So we really get this emphasis of the symbolism or the combination of the sign and the planet. So, you know, thinking of, you know, for listeners who will already, I'm sure, have an understanding of Mercury and Earth signs, you know, that's a big theme for 2016. But we're really starting that now. We're starting Mercury in Capricorn, and that's pretty much our Mercury vibe for the next couple of months.
And speaking of, so I should probably mention my first election for the month, which actually takes place right at the beginning, which is December 3rd. And this is actually one of my favorite elections. I had a lot of difficulties finding elections in the later part of this year. And I actually remember when, Austin, you were looking for a marriage election, and you first asked me to help you find one. I was having a hard time, and I think you actually ended up finding a really amazing one with the position of Venus.
Well, you have to say that now.
Right. I have to say that in retrospect. I could say, well,
no more commentary allowed.
Yeah.
Only positive.
You'd be like, it was all right. I mean, so this is one of my favorite elections, of the later part of this year. And it has been for a while. Let me, share it with you guys.
While you do that, Chris, I did notice that hotspot period with the, roller coaster was a week that you had avoided with your elections.
Oh, at the end of December?
The middle period, that kind of 6th to the 11th kind of time.
Yeah, I mean, part of my comment for December is that I really have nothing for the second half of December. I do have one election that I throw out there that I'll mention later, but it's really not that good. So honestly, my little statement this month is do the big stuff at the beginning of the month and kind
of avoid. At the start of the month.
That's great. That's actually totally my plan.
Okay, so
very good. I want to be done and just be in my comfy bomb shelter with alcohol and turkey for the second half.
That's fantastic, because I'm actually taking 2 weeks off at the end of December, which I have never done before. So, Chris, we're all vibing you.
Yeah, astrology develops your timing.
Yeah.
Right. So let's see. Well, let's see what you guys think about the election first. So this is my first election, and it's one of my favorite ones of the month. So it has Gemini rising, and it has a lineup of three planets in Sagittarius in the seventh whole sign house. So the ruler of the ascendant is Mercury, which is located in Sagittarius in the seventh house. And Mercury is actually applying to a square with Jupiter in Virgo in the fourth whole sign house, but each planet is in the other's domicile. So Mercury is in Sagittarius and Jupiter is in Virgo, and they're applying to a close degree-based aspect within a couple of degrees. So this is actually a true case of a mutual reception. Right. So some astrologers might not look on this favorably because the two planets are in the signs of their detriment or their exile. But I actually think that being in a mutual reception like this, especially in a day chart where Jupiter is more positive and otherwise making them angular and generally well-placed, is a sufficient sort of mitigation so that it strengthens their condition and makes them worth using rather than something to avoid, especially compared to what else you could use or what else is available. So that's the sort of the focal point of the election. Then you layer on top of that that the moon is in Virgo in the fourth whole sign house, and it's applying to conjunction with Jupiter. So you've got a nice little moon-Jupiter conjunction in the fourth. We do have Saturn in the seventh, but as long as you make this a day chart, I don't think that's going to be a huge, huge impediment. The day chart thing will offset it. The only catch to that is that the window of opportunity for this election is actually extremely, or is pretty narrow. So you've got to do it once the Senate moves into Sagittarius. So you've got to do it after that, so that Gemini, or once the ascendant moves into Gemini, you've got to do it with Gemini rising, but you've got to make sure it happens before sunset, which will take place once the sun gets to the descendant at 11 degrees of Sagittarius. So you've only got maybe I think it's like a 20 or 30 minute window, which is plenty of time to sort of initiate most things. But you have to keep that in mind, because if this did switch over to a night chart, I do think that Saturn would become a serious impediment and a serious problem, especially within the context of partnerships or other people that you're working with or people outside of you. It's also notable that Jupiter is in a superior sign-based square with reception over Saturn, which I think is another mitigating condition that's not just helpful for Saturn and offsetting that placement, but also for all three of the Sagittarius planets. We've also got Venus in Libra, still barely in its own sign in the fifth whole sign house. Mars is also in the fifth, which is a little bit problematic for fifth house matters, but ultimately Venus being in decent shape, I think, balances it out. So that's the chart. It's probably primarily good for seventh house and fourth house things. It's very much focused on the seventh and the fourth, and the rulers of those signs are relatively well-placed and interacting relatively favorably with each other. Even though they're applying through square, the fact that they're in mutual reception makes it a very constructive, very useful square rather than a more difficult or tenuous one.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, one thing to note is that the Jupiter and the Mercury, which are both in signs which are foreign to them, but are potentially dignified by their, within a degree aspect and being in mutual reception at the level of sign rulership. So, what you've done here and what I think is a good lesson for people is that whenever you have a mutable sign rising, it means that Jupiter and Mercury rule the whole of the angular houses.
Right.
And if you're going to do an immutable rising, like look at Mercury, because they're basically going to rule all the pivots. And that's exactly what you've done. I think that's not only a nice election in the middle of a not amazing time, but it also illustrates that perfectly.
And there's also an alternate one. Go ahead, Kelly. I'll just pull up the other chart.
I was just going to say, the other thing I really like about that chart is that the support from the moon. The moon is cuddling up to Jupiter, but it's actually going to hit by degree, I think, Mercury first. So the moon is kind of bouncing between those two key pivot rulers or angular house rulers. And there's something about the support from the moon, like when the moon has good light and where is the moon throwing that light? It's a little bit of a benefit or a boost that there's some energy or support that those planets get from that interaction from the moon, in addition to the heavy emphasis there on the seventh and fourth houses. I mean, it's clearly a chart for topics associated with those areas of life.
And it's also nice because the moon rules the second. So this is one of the few elections where it's like people always want several houses to be good for different topics. They're like, make the 10th house good and make the 7th house good. And I want, relationships and my friendships and everything else.
I want my money too.
Right. And then they throw in the money. And it's really hard oftentimes to also get the money house well placed. But this is one of those charts where also like the financial house is extremely well placed because the ruler is the moon, and it's applying to that conjunction with Jupiter. So there's an alternate for this chart that you can use that illustrates the point that Austin was just making, which is that basically anytime you put one of the mutable signs on the angles, the same two planets are going to rule all four signs. So this is a variant of the same chart, which is set for earlier that day on December 3rd, at 12:30 p.m. and wherever your location is. I forgot to mention the time on the previous one. The previous one is December 3rd, 2015 at 4:10 p.m. Or basically just before sunset. So the alternate chart, it's the same chart. It just has Pisces rising, so that Jupiter is the ruler of the ascendant, and it's again placed in the seventh whole sign house, this time in Virgo, in a mutual reception with Mercury, which is in the 10th house. And Mercury is applying to a conjunction or a square with Jupiter with reception. The moon is applying to the square with Mercury with reception, and then the conjunction with Jupiter. So again, it's the ruler of the ascendant in the seventh. So again, it's a very like partnership or relationship oriented election, but this one's a little bit more focused on 10th house matters pertaining to career than the other one. The only thing I don't like about it as much as the other one, and the reason why I recommend the 4-10 chart over this one typically for most things, is that the financial sector of this chart, if that's important in your election, is not as well placed because it has Aries on the cusp of the second house, and it's ruled by Mars in a day chart in the 8th, which is otherwise not really terribly well placed. So those are my two charts for early December.
Nice. You know, I feel like we should just say a little bit about what it's going to be like to have planets go through Sagittarius this December, because Sagittarius is ruled by Jupiter, and we have the ruler of Sag, Jupiter, in Virgo, which is a notably awkward place. And there is a square or a 90-degree angle between Virgo and Sagittarius. And so some of their significations are naturally frictive in relationship to one another. On a very simple level, Sagittarius, where we're going to have Saturn, where we're going to have the Sun for a lot of the month, where we're going to have Mercury for half the month, is a place of go fast, get things done. Right, like the symbol of Sagittarius has a horse body for going fast and a bow for nailing different projects or achieving different goals or picking targets, right? And then, but we have as the ruler or the guiding principle, we have Jupiter and Virgo, which on a very simple level, Virgo is about doing everything extremely thoroughly. So we have tension between that's good enough, let's move on. And, you know, we got 100 things to do. We've only got so much time. Come on. Versus like, well, everything needs to be done right. And so I think a lot of people will experience a very general tension between how much time do I spend on these things? What can I prioritize versus what just needs to be scratched off the list?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think that probably will peak, if you like, around the Sun-Jupiter square, which is around the 14th, so right mid-month, with those two planets. And that'll be the first time they've formed that particular configuration. I don't think we would have had a sextile from the Sun in Scorpio back to Jupiter and Virgo, but different vibe there altogether. Mm-hmm. So it's a great way that you've described it, Austin, that difference between the hurry up and get it done, which is so sad, and the Virgo, I just want to make sure I did it right, to the exclusion of all else. And so maybe for people to be prepared to make choices between those two mindsets or those two sort of operating guidelines or operating principles, that, you know, some circumstances you'll be better off just getting things done, Sag, and others you'll be better off paying attention, but maybe not trying to do it all in every situation.
Right, because you can't.
You can't, yeah. You have to say, this is a Sag sitch or this is a Virgo sitch, and I'm going to apply myself accordingly. That could be a bit of a Kelly shorthand there, a Sag situation or a Virgo situation.
And this will be the first, one of the things I noticed, and it's connected with an observation Austin made not too long ago about the Sun Saturn conjunction in Scorpio, is that this will be the first Sun Saturn conjunction in Sagittarius this month, which seems really notable, because, you know, the last 3 years have been Sun Saturn conjunctions in Scorpio. So that sort of ties into a little bit of your theme, because even from Saturn, we get a little bit of a, you know, sort of slow down vibe as it's going through Sagittarius rather than, you know, allowing it to speed up, that there's something holding things back and requiring greater thought and sort of deliberation than usual.
Right. Well, and you also just have the, You have the general Sag thing, which is like run around fast and do things, but Saturn's there. So it's like you have 20 minutes to accomplish as many things as you can from this list, and you will be graded on how well you've done each of them.
Sure.
Just to give an example from my life, a lot of what I have to do before Christmas is I have maybe 50,000 words to edit different people's essays for a project that I'm working on, right? And so editing is, we could say that editing is a Virgo sitch, but at the same time, things need to go to the printer, so I can't spend 20 hours on each 5,000 word essay. Right. Which is what I would like to do with my Saturn in Virgo. But, you know, this is it. You know, it's literally how deep do you go versus how much time do you have? Right. And there's got to be a compromise, especially, you know, if you find yourself involved in the type of labor which has potential infinite depth. I think both writing and editing have that.
Totally.
Virgo is Mercury ruled, right? And especially if you have planets natally in Virgo and or Sagittarius, like myself, you know, it's quite likely that you'll have situations like this and you need to make some judgment calls because you don't have infinite time to do infinite things.
Yeah, that I ran into that recently with that perfections lecture where I got up to like 119 slides for the PowerPoint. I've been preparing it for like years. And then I realized that the first 75% on the basic method of perfections was done, but there was still this other one, which was going to take another 100 slides for the advanced method of perfections. And I decided I had to cut it off at some point. So I just did really as far as I could. I went as far as I could with the basic method of perfections, which is the first 75% of the lecture. And then I squeezed in a sort of, you know, overview of some main points of the advanced method in the last 25%, and then just called it a day and recorded the lecture. But it was nice because it also matched with the other thing you said the other day, Austin, which is that I just had 2 days to record it. So I knew I had 2 days to record 119 slides, and it did take me until like 2 a.m. on the final day, but I got it done.
Oh my God. You're just marathon man, Chris, like honestly.
Yeah, so that's why this is the first podcast this month as well. So my apologies to the listeners, but hopefully some good things will come out of it pretty soon.
Yeah. So self-imposed limits, I guess, is that, or that kind of internal regulation. And that's, I think, you know, Austin, I totally relate to the editing, writing side of things. And Chris, the presentation, you know, anytime we're giving a lecture at a conference or in an online platform, you want to tell everything, but you're naturally bound by the 75-minute amount of time that you have, which invokes a sense of, well, I can't do everything. And so limits are not bad. I think that's one thing that the Saturn in Sag, you know, it's really about how we relate to Saturn, I think, is the idea that limits can be helpful and they can give you guidelines and they can give you a sense of containment. So rather than rile against them, do what you can within them, essentially.
Yeah, and learn how to have your own self-imposed limits, and that sometimes that can be a good thing rather than something that's burdensome or oppressive, because that, I guess that's part of the lesson, is sort of Saturn and Sag a little bitter in terms of what I'm coming to terms with, where you have a subject that could be like just boundless and that you could talk about.
Sag, it's running forever.
Right.
Yeah.
You could talk about for 200 or 300 slides, but at some point you have to cut it off and have some limits, and maybe developing some of that, the idea of developing, you know, setting your own personal limits might be a good sort of lesson over this time period.
You go, Austin.
Oh, I was going to say, and, you know, while we're talking about trying to manage whatever Saturn and Sag is lording over in your life, you know, Saturn is really tightly square Neptune for the whole month, right? And so that makes it a little harder. That makes it more important, but it also makes it harder.
Yeah.
Neptune is a planet that we can... pretty much everybody agrees, no matter what else they say, that it's really not about boundaries or or being concise. And so that, you know, within a degree square makes it harder and probably more important for Saturn, you know, to find proper limits. And it may be more difficult to find them, but it's also more crucial.
Yes. And the one, this is a tiny soundbite for Saturn that I come back to, and I'm finding it a lot with Saturn in Sag particularly, is this idea of quality over quantity. That to do something well within that whatever limited time frame you have, rather than, you know, to try and do everything.
Definitely. That's a huge Saturn theme. And I see that really prominently in people that have Saturn prominently placed. Like one of the people I always think of, or that immediately invokes for me is Robert Schmidt, who does everything he does to like an extremely high quality, but sometimes he focuses so much on doing things in the high quality that he's never able to like let it go and release it. And so you run into that dual issue sometimes of when is it good enough to let go versus at the same time wanting to have very high standards and put out something that's very quality and covers all the bases.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, the mythological Saturn, Cronus, provides a sort of bizarre inverted birth allegory in that one of Cronus's main myths involves him swallowing his children. And if we're talking about, you know, metaphorically, especially when we're using a mythical form of metaphor, having children is creating, right? And gods have children, you know, they accidentally cry and kids spring up from that, or they cut their foot and blood comes out and they have kids from that. Gods are always having kids, right? And so if we take children as sort of a, you know, a biological metaphor for the creative act, there's this tendency with Saturn to hold all of the children inside. In that case, he's literally, you know, devouring them, right? And so we have this weird oral inversion of the, you know, of the process of giving birth, right? Instead of the babies coming out, the babies are going in the mouth, right? And so we have to let go at a certain
point. Great point, Austin.
Really? Okay, I thought maybe it was just kind of Freudian and bizarre.
I liked it. I mean, you know me, it doesn't have to be totally G-rated or pleasant. that was great. Because that's so true. The Saturn is a binding energy. It's a holding on. And we need to have them, you know, coming back out. I love that.
Definitely. And speaking of Saturn, that's actually my second election. So, yeah, you like that?
Good.
Did you like that segue?
I had a solstice segue for Saturn, but you go with your election.
Okay. Well, yeah, yours. Okay, I'll do mine because mine's on the 14th, and then we'll
have enough elections. Yeah.
All right. So, right now, actually, during this time, I actually noticed this in November as well, but it's also true for a large part of December, where. And this is an issue I've actually been running into. I don't know, maybe you guys have had this as well, where sometimes when you're writing a column months ahead of time, you'll have a hard time sort of like finding, especially for elections, like good elections during that time period, as you're sort of trying to do a cursory glance over like a large swath of the year. But then when you actually get to that time period and you're in the middle of feeling what the energies are, but also you know what's available versus what's not, because you're actually doing things on a day-to-day basis at that point, sometimes you start seeing elections or time frames once you actually get there that you didn't notice that you didn't notice originally months earlier. So I found that actually with some very great elections during November and December, where you can use Aquarius rising and make Saturn the ruler of the ascendant. And then Saturn is located in Sagittarius in the 11th whole sign house in a day chart, because during this part of the year, the sun is in the top half of the chart. So the sun is in the 11th house in this chart. Saturn is in Sagittarius, and it's actually got a superior sign-based square from Jupiter, which is located at 22 Virgo in the 8th whole sign house with reception. So that's actually a condition of bonification where Jupiter is affirming or confirming and stabilizing what Saturn wants to indicate. So aside from that, the chart also features the moon in the first house in Aquarius applying to a sextile with Saturn with reception. So that's also very positive and strengthening and sort of focusing on Saturn's placement. Venus is in the 10th in Scorpio, which is sort of okay. The Mercury is not doing great. It's over in Capricorn in the 12th, but it's not a very Mercury-focused election. It's more focused on the Saturn element. So it's actually a pretty good election for 11th house matters, or at least it's pretty focused on 11th house matters with the ruler of the ascendant there. The ruler of the 11th itself is in the 8th, which potentially normally could indicate some difficulties, but the fact that it's a benefic that's of the sect in favor, that's a very relatively positive planet, kind of balances that out, so that you would expect the more positive spectrum of the 8th house significations, like financial benefits from other people's money or other people's financial matters positively affecting the native potentially.
Well, and I also just want to add, there's that north node is getting really close to Jupiter. Mm. And if we see the north node as an intensifier of whatever it touches, which is one of the sort of traditional schools of thought, that's a lot of extra juice for Jupiter and Virgo, which Jupiter and Virgo might need.
Definitely. And I mean, one thing that's interesting, if you just look at like natal astrology, I've noticed a lot of people that are millionaires or billionaires sometimes having heavy eighth house placements. So sometimes, this notion of the eighth house being other people's money, sometimes that can get channeled in a very personal direction that ends up being useful for the native or useful for the person initiating the action, especially in charts like this where Jupiter is the ruler of the second house, and it is the ruler of the 11th house as well, which the ruler of the ascendant is located in. So the chart would be especially good for, let's say, like initiating actions that involve 11th house sort of people, which is like friends and groups and alliances and social movements, but especially ones that are supposed to have some sort of positive financial benefit, or in which other people's resources and finances is tied into the picture in a positive way. That would be the most specific thing you could probably use this for. But in terms of other things, it's just a good general electional chart as well. As long as you're not doing something more ninth housey, I do think one of the shortcomings of this election is you start getting into the thick of the Mars-Uranus-Pluto square, and Mars being in a day chart in the ninth whole sign house is potentially a bit problematic for some ninth house matters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's my other good chart or good electional chart for this month. There's other, just during this time, other Aquarius rising charts that you could use that I would recommend taking advantage of. Because we're not going to have those actually once we get to most of next year, because at that point, if you do Aquarius rising, the sun is going to be below the horizon. So you would end up with Saturn contrary to the sect in a night chart, which generally you want to try to avoid for electional purposes. All right. So yeah. And cool. Then there's one other election later in the month, but it's really not one that I actually recommend very much. It's just sort of usable
if you have to.
Yeah, and that's December 21st, which is connected to what our next segment will be. But December 21st at 11:30 in the morning, I forgot to say actually that the previous chart, just to clarify, on December 14th was at 9:55 in the morning with early Aquarius rising. So the December 21st chart is at 11:30 in the morning with mid Pisces rising, Jupiter ruling the ascendant, placed in the 7th. The Sun and Saturn are in Sagittarius in the 10th. The Moon is in Taurus, exalted in the 3rd, and applying to a somewhat wide trine with Jupiter. But the downside is that Mercury is really closely tied in with conjunction with Pluto and a square with Uranus, and it's going to then be applying to a square with Mars. So Mercury,
it's actually applying to a sextile with Venus.
Okay, well, that's a good little offsetting sort of factor then. But
yeah, that'll be the first one.
Right, but otherwise still in kind of a tension-based thing. So while this would be an acceptable election, it's at least not got Mercury in a very favorable condition, so there could be some problems with communication or messaging or other things. Okay, so yeah, do you want to talk about the solstice, Kelly?
Well, I just thought since we're astrologers, we probably should mention the solstice. But then since we live in the Western world in the 21st century, we also need to talk about Christmas. So, yeah, the solstice, just that it's happening, of course, that it's that big turning point of the sun. I looked, I think it's the 21st here in Canada and the U.S., and I wanted to give the date for Australia for our listeners down there. It's the 21st in Australia, so it'll be early morning here in North America on the 21st and in the evening in Australia. So see how quick. Might be like 4:45 in the morning, Chris.
It looks like it switches over in the evening.
Oh, maybe. I beg your pardon. I'm doing Eastern, so it might. Okay. It might be like late on the 20th. Hang on.
As long as I have this right and I'm not messing something up with the animate chart feature, it looks like.
Oh, shit. I've got the solstice date for 2016. So okay. Oh, God. I'll just adjust that for Sydney. Oh, my God. What a gong show. Okay.
So it looks like it's just before 10 p.m. Mountain time, at least December 21st.
Too funny. We like to give people a heads up, but that's probably a little bit too much. Yeah, I've got just before 3 p.m. on the 22nd for 2015 in Australia. I think the segue from Saturn there is that that's really the big shift into, you know, the sun in Capricorn. Just tones things down a little bit from all the rah-rah Sagittarius. We'll already have Mercury in Capricorn. Just kind of invites a little bit more of that yin or introspective, the softer energy. And then there's a prelude. Of course, we do have a big full moon in Cancer on December 25th. I'm pretty sure that's in all the major time zones. So I thought that was an interesting pairing of astrological event, full moon in Cancer, with Christmas Day, which is not necessarily everybody's celebrating it, but a lot of people are obviously going to be doing family stuff under this very sensitive and emotional family full moon. I don't know. Yeah, what do you guys think?
I think Uranus stations direct on that day.
Yes, that's exactly right. You had mentioned that. So it's sort of an energetically alive day, in addition to it being a culturally significant date, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it's always interesting when we get stuff that happens around that Christmas period, because everybody seems to be running a little bit more sensitively, or things are a little bit more heightened. So you run a station plus a full moon. I don't know. Do we go come back to the outbursts or release kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, because even Mercury is getting up there to the square with Mars at that point. It's at 22 Capricorn and Mars is at 24 Libra. So it's really shifting a lot of the focus back to the cardinal signs, as if, you know, you thought you got away from the cardinal square or the cardinal pileup of T-square planets over the past decade, but then some other planets come in and sort of reconnect to those in a way that's kind of tense.
Totally.
Yeah. What I do like about it is that Uranus stationing direct. So, you know, whenever a planet stations, it's thought to provide very clear events and experiences of the nature of that planet. And Uranus in Aries has been a big fan of breaking old patterns or existing structures in the interest of personal sovereignty, or the sovereignty or freedom of a particular, you know, demographic, right? On a family context, which full moon in Cancer is certainly a family context, and so is the holiday, because the full moon occurs at 3 Capricorn and 3 Cancer, and Uranus is all the way over at 16, I guess I would like to believe that in any case, some of these family, these family moments may provide a breakthrough, a positive breakthrough, or a casting away or shattering of old patterns that isn't immediately traumatic or bloody, you know, as we don't have this super tight, you know, that Mars is still in Libra, but it's long past departed from any of our players here, and the moment of the full moon is more than 24 hours before the moon actually hits Uranus by square. So there's enough slack with this arrangement that we don't have. It doesn't have to, you know, it doesn't need to or even want terribly to be explosive.
Okay, so the key word for Christmas is not immediately traumatic or bloody.
Right.
That sounds fair.
The other thing too is the moon is in Cancer. It's a well-dignified full moon. And I think the points Austin are making, if I put my rosy spin on it,
I thought I put a rosy spin on.
That was very rosy.
Language is not rosy. Not traumatic. There is, I mean, personally, I'm just thinking, oh, this is all lovely. And I'm not necessarily saying it will be lovely for everyone, but my personal family story this Christmas is my husband and I are going back to celebrate with my family in Australia for the first time in our 7 years of being together, which is exciting in and of itself. But we're also going to be celebrating with my brand new baby nephew, so the first grandchild in the family, who was born earlier this year. So there's a sense of like the gathering, the generations, the connection, the lineage, the Cancer moon, the memories, you know, the family line. It's different. It's not necessarily what will always be happening, but there's a freshness. Maybe the Uranus spin is a freshness.
Yeah, new baby, new first time you've done it in 7 years. Like those are pattern breaking things. Those are out of the ordinary.
Yes,
is a good example of what Uranus can do when it's not, you know,
being traumatic,
flipping over your board game.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there are some actually very nice flowing aspects, which I think is part of what you're pointing out, because like Venus and Jupiter and Mercury are all getting to the same degrees of you know, feminine signs, so they're all forming some nice trines and sextiles with each other at that time. So it seems like people that have some of those placements around 22 degrees of some of the mutable signs and some of the fixed signs, well, or even some of the cardinal signs. Some of the signs will do very well. I mean, that looks like Mercury's trine Jupiter exactly at 22 yeah. Virgo and 22 Capricorn, and it's sextiling Venus at 24 Scorpio, and Venus, yeah, is sextiling Jupiter. But then you got this other end of the spectrum where you've got some tension between Mercury and Mars and some of the cardinal stuff. So it's all going to depend on if you've got some of those heavy cardinal placements falling at critical points in your chart, or if you've got some of those mutable or fixed placements falling at critical points in your chart. That's probably going to dictate how it goes.
For sure. And then, yeah, just the Venus sextile Jupiter and the Mercury trine Jupiter, those two aspects do peak like December 24, 25, 26. The Mercury Mars, because Mercury is going a little bit slower, that one actually doesn't become exact until sort of the 29th or the 30th. So it's a couple of days.
Oh, interesting.
Sort of we're out of the thick of that Christmas Boxing Day holiday period.
Yeah, and that Mercury Mars is going to happen again and then again.
Oh, right. This is just the first one.
Yeah.
Because it'll retrograde.
So, yeah, just to have those sort of Venus, Jupiter, Mercury trines and sextiles over the Christmas period. Yeah. It's definitely a nicer Christmas astrologically than what we've seen in the last couple of years when the Uranus-Pluto square has been tighter.
Right.
And then I think you wanted to mention New Year's Eve as well, Kelly.
I just didn't know. I mean, that's a question people often ask, you know, online and stuff, is what's the astrology like of New Year's Eve and will it be good for a party? And I think this year the big standout is Moon Jupiter, essentially, which not necessarily on the night of New Year's Eve. I think it'll probably peak on the afternoon. Mm-hmm. The people down in Australia actually will probably get it and it will be visible, actually, so it'll be beautiful. But that's a, you know, Moon Jupiter North Node is a fairly, I don't know. It just looked, without being extravagant because it's Virgo, just a little fun. I don't know. What did you guys think? Do you ever think about like when people are like, oh, what kind of a celebration are we going to do this year? Check out the chart.
I mean, my keyword for Moon Jupiter conjunction Virgo would be something like cautiously optimistic.
Of course.
Something like that. But yeah, it does look very nice.
Well, I would say Moon Jupiter North Node, thumbs up. Venus's very recent ingress into Sagittarius at that point, thumbs up.
Yeah.
Really tight Mercury Mars square.
Thumbs down.
Don't get drunk and get in arguments with people. It's right there. Like if you wanna get in an argument with somebody after you guys have had some drinks, you totally can. The option is very much available. You don't have to, but it's totally there for you.
Oh, that's fantastic. And that, I guess that wraps up the month just from a main aspect thing.
Well, I think there's one thing that we should talk about.
What else? Yes, Austin.
We didn't talk about the fact that Venus is going to be in Scorpio for almost the entire month.
But we're trying to ignore that, aren't we? I did find, actually, Chris, you put a beautiful quote on Twitter in the last week or two about planets in detriment. Mm-hmm. And it was on the Mars in Libra example, but you said it's basically like trying to dress up a soldier in a tutu, which I thought was great for Mars in Libra. And ever since then, I've been trying to come up with one for Venus in Scorpio that was actually PG-13 rated, and I failed miserably. So,
oh well, it's just, you know, it's the like kind of depressive goth girl in high school.
Goth girl, that's a good one. That's a good one.
And she kind of hates you, and she probably has some good reasons, but she won't necessarily tell you why.
No, they're in the vault. Nobody's going to know why.
Yeah, or we can go gender equal. There are lots of goth guys that can easily qualify as Venus as well. We can go the Shuker route. But, like, you know, I think Venus and Scorpio is interesting because it's one of these detriments where we have a planet that's in its triplicity dignity.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Venus has triplicity dignity in every water sign. Do Venus and water make sense? Yes, they do. Can you feel things and enjoy things when Venus is in water sign? Absolutely.
Totes, yeah.
However, there's this special disadvantage when Venus is in Scorpio that we take into account in addition to that, not instead of that, right? So Venus isn't like, you know, Venus is capable of relating or capable of doing business because she has triplicity dignity in Scorpio. But there's this detriment. And so the detriment I see as what I see every year, both in people's lives as well as my own, is that there's a tendency for that very awake and capable sort of capacity for feeling to get sucked down into feeling negative things, into dwelling on like what I don't like about this person. And it's very similar to Venus's fall in Virgo, where she also has triplicity dignity, where it's like getting stuck on the one thing that's wrong or externally with Virgo. And then with Venus in Scorpio, it's the getting stuck on the like the one thing you can't trust about a person or you're uncertain about, or that, you know, that creates some fear or anxiety. Right. And then natally, this is to a certain degree, you can see this when Venus and Scorpio hits natal positions, but I think you really need natal positions for this, is that I've noticed that there's a tendency with some folks who have, especially let's call them feeling planets in Scorpio, to keep pushing deeper and deeper into a relationship and getting more and more intimate until they hit the thing that they don't need, which is the like, let's get close until keep getting closer until I hate you. Right. It's like digging deeper and deeper and deeper and like finding all sorts of interesting stuff until you hit like a power line. And, you know, the remedy for that is just to like remember that if you do that with anybody, you're eventually going to find something you don't like, and to not get stuck on that if you don't have to.
There's Venus sextiling Pluto right about December 17th, which might be a good, you know, thing in terms of what you're talking about, or good window for that in terms of digging deeper and finding things.
Yeah. Well, and if you're going to do a sort of relentless drilling, like just know that you will find something you don't like if you're dealing with another human being, and that, you know, you both need to have within, you know, the parameters of your relationship, the space to work through those things. But if you don't have that kind of relationship with someone, like don't keep pushing closer and closer, because you're just going to hit a power line or something gross, like a, you know, buried body or something. Metaphorically
speaking. Right. Yeah. And then it looks like later in the month, as we said before, around December 24th, Venus completes the sextile with Jupiter. So there's some positive sort of flowing things coming out of that Venus placement in Scorpio at that time, which seems pretty nice.
Yeah.
We should do a show at some point, because I was just thinking about that, like the clothing analogy of planets in different signs as being like a great way to make analogies for the planets. I mean,
it would probably be really helpful for people that are learning and getting their head around it.
Right. Definitely. I mean, you guys were talking about, what was your example of Venus in Scorpio again? It was the goth girl.
Yeah, goth girl. Like the person who's very like you know, it's the goth person in high school who's like, really, they're very aesthetically oriented, right? Like goth culture is not un-Venusian at all. Like lots of fashion, lots of very like carefully crafted appearance. But tending to focus on the negative.
Sure.
Right. Like, I think of myself when I was like a 15-year-old Marilyn Manson fan.
Gosh,
everybody.
The other two I can think of for Venus and Scorpio, just right off the top of my head, one would be the dominatrix. The other would be Kali, the Indian or what Hindu goddess.
Oh, the
Kali.
Goddess. Yes.
Right, because you're like, oh, it's a goddess. That sounds nice. And then it's like, well, it's a goddess with like a belt made out of human skulls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think Kali is a little too big a figure. You know, Kali is... especially Mahakali is thought to be sort of the womb out of which everything emerges and returns to. So that might be a little the symbolism. I think is you have to really condense that in a way that's not very accurate. If you want to just describe one Venus position, I know that that's what it looks like, but having spent some time with the, with that figure, I feel like, that's not a great one because it kind of only deals with the one manner in which she's depicted rather than the actual meaning of that figure.
Yeah, I mean, well, my analogy of like Mars and a tutu is not exactly the most nuanced sort of analogy in drawing out the potential, you know, multivalent meanings of.
But Mars and a tutu is not like honored and revered by millions of people.
All right. I'll point taken. All right. Well, maybe we'll do a show like that at some point, in the future and see what other sort of analogies that we can come up with. And for that matter, since this is going to be the end of the year, we might want to talk about our next forecasting episode being like an outlook for the year ahead. That's actually what Austin and I did last year is we actually did a look at 2015, but it would be nice if the three of us could maybe turn the next episode into a broader outlook for the next year.
Sure.
Cool. All right. Well, are there any points that you guys wanted to mention as we're getting towards the end of this and starting to wrap things up?
I mean, I think it's just going to be a sprint. I think it's just going to be a sprint until planets hit Capricorn. Like, that's kind of what the month's going to feel like.
Very frantic and very getting everything done.
Mm-hmm.
And then with that particularly hectic week in the second week with the Mars, Pluto, Uranus.
Definitely. All right. And my advice from the electional perspective is get everything done in the first half of the month because that's when the great elections are. And then just, I don't know, take it easy the second half of the month or continue on and bring to completion things you've already initiated.
Yes. Yeah, sprint and then take a breather.
Take a break. A well-earned one.
All right. Well, that sounds like a good note to end on. All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you want to find out any more information about our guests, our co-hosts, what are your websites again, guys?
AustinCopic.com, and that's Austin, AustinCopic.com.
And mine's KellySAstrology.com, or you can find me on Facebook or Twitter, where I seem to be attracting some new followers. So you can come and chat to me there, too.
Excellent. And
I just hit 3,000 people on Twitter.
I know. I'm really jealous because we used to be like around the same, like at 1,000 followers, and then you just far exceeded me. So I have to up my Twitter game, I think.
You know what's happened? I don't feel like I've been doing that much, but... and I don't necessarily want people to make a judgment here, but John Edwards, you know, the psychic medium guy, somehow started following me, and every now and then he'll retweet something, and I'm quite sure that's helping.
All right. Well, I need to get my own, like, friend psychic follower then at some point.
I'll just retweet you, and maybe he'll retweet you as well. Who knows?
Okay. Also, thanks for our guests for our audience and people who joined the show. I appreciate you guys joining us and, you know, sending in some of the questions as we're talking here and also for your support to keep the show going and keep us, you know, churning out new episodes. All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of this episode. So thanks everyone for listening and we'll see you next time.